Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, a co-host of the New Book Network's New Books in Popular Culture, and I'm here today with Jack Hamilton, author of Just Around Midnight, Rock and Roll and the Racial Imagination. Thanks for being here, Jack.
Thanks so much for having me, Rebecca.
Great. I'd like to start out by having you just sort of share a little bit about what brought you to this topic, what got you interested in it, and what got you started on this book.
Sure. So it's actually, it's quite a... or a long story, or at least a story that goes back a long way. I first really became interested in this subject really from being a musician. I started playing piano when I was about 6 years old. And then when I was in high school, I was in a lot of bands. And then I actually spent a number of years in my late teens and early 20s being as a full-time professional musician. And so I just spent a lot of time around musicians, and the bands that I was in were mostly like blues and R&B bands. I wasn't really in rock bands. So I was playing forms of music that at the time that I was playing them, which was, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, it was somewhat unusual for a young white person like myself to be playing them. And so that was like an interesting, and I had like just such a wonderful time in those years and met so many interesting people, but it made me kind of interested in the way that we think about the sort of intersection of musical identity, or sorry, racial identity and sort of kinds of music, you know, what types of people we expect to play different types of music. Like certainly something I would encounter pretty frequently during those years was people asking, you know, well, why aren't you in a rock band? That was always sort of interesting to me because I knew obviously, and even in those days, I was like, well, you know, rock is actually not originally a white music. it was always a strange question to field. And then I went back to college after those years and then started working as a music journalist and music critic, and that was a really important experience for me as well in terms of thinking about the way that writing about music sort of structures the way people listen to it and the way and the role that critics and journalists have played over the years in sort of the reception of popular music, the way the history of popular music has been told. That was something I was always interested in too from those years, was sort of the role of music critics and, you know, kind of the rise of rock criticism and how influential a form that has been. Ultimately ended up in graduate school, which was sort of, I kind of came to as a refugee from journalism, as quite a few people do. I knew I wanted to write about music, and it all sort of, so those two interests kind of came together, and particularly around the 1960s, which struck me as a period where there was a lot of rupture in terms of sort of like the ways people had thought about what types of music black and white people were supposed to be making. There was a lot of just a tremendous amount of fluidity in that decade and just a lot of really interesting things happening in the world of popular music. And then by the end of the decade, the music has really kind of resegregated itself, and you have what rock music as sort of seen as a really overwhelmingly white form and something that really that is thought of as something that just white people do. And concurrent to that is actually the rise of rock criticism as a serious form, and just a huge amount of really influential writing in that period.
Right. And so you start out your book with this idea that you're going to tell two stories, right? The story of the audience and sort of what's going on with the audience in the discourse, but also the music itself and the role of the artist and performers. And I really appreciated that angle. I think that's really important. And when you were talking about sort of rock criticism, that idea of myth making and how we create these sort of mythologies and larger than life images in rock. So could you talk a little bit about why you wanted to tell both of those stories and how you sort of weave that together?
Yeah. So, I mean, like, I think that, like, you know, I think in some ways, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of the music that I write about is incredibly famous and stuff that everyone, right. a lot of people know, you know, and we think we know really well. And yet at the same time, there has been a lot of sort of received wisdom that's been passed down about it. And so one of the things that I wanted to do was sort of push at the received wisdom and write, you know, I don't want to say mm-hmm. necessarily a revisionist history or something like that, but sort of like, well, where do we find these ideas emerging? Like, you know, some of these standard stories of rock history that like, you know, Dylan goes electric and nothing is the same, or, you know, the Beatles make Sgt. Pepper and nothing is the same. So I was sort of like, you know, I'd always found those stories somewhat suspicious. I understand why to writers they're very appealing. I think as writers are always, particularly critics, are always looking for turning points and, you know, moments of sort of epochal significance. I'm certainly guilty of that sometimes myself. It's like just the way that I was interested in some of these, the sort of myths of the 60s. And 60s music is just such a mythic decade in a lot right. of ways. But at the same time, you know, I didn't want to tell I didn't want to make it seem like I was like throwing those artists themselves under the bus. Like, it's like, you know, it's like, I don't think that, you know, it's like, I really love the Beatles music. Like, the Beatles are really right. great.
Right. But they're still complicated, but they're great. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, I didn't want to write a book that just seemed like I was just throwing out all this music. So I sort of decided to, yeah, like, you know, it's like, well, what happens if we just sort of try to hear this music in different ways than, you know, rather than saying like, oh, you know, rather than trying to reconstruct some sort of alternative canon of 60s music, you know, which would be, you know, which in a lot of ways is a worthwhile venture. But at the same time, like, that canon has been extremely powerful. Right. So in some ways, like, to construct an alternative canon of that music is to write about something slightly different than what's been passed down. You know, like, it's like, I mean, to try to write a history of 60s rock music without writing about the Beatles or the Stones or Dylan or Janis Joplin or Jimi Hendrix or something, like, while that could certainly be done, I think that was a different project than what I was interested in. And it was sort of like trying to get at other stories and, again, like, sort of a more interracial story that's less confined by the genre constructions that have sort of informed the way that that we've come to think about that decade.
Right. Yeah, I really appreciate it. You said at the beginning that your goal is to help you hear music better, mm-hmm. right? So that idea of really thinking about what you're listening to and how it's ingrained. I've had this discussion with a lot of people about that you talk about the whitening of rock, right? Mm-hmm. And that it's like, we either just don't talk about it, or African-Americans are self-segregating, or there's this idea of theft. And we don't look at the complexities of that a lot often in those conversations, mm-hmm. right? It's like either, you know, Elvis stole all the music and that's it, or there's this, like, we're going to either listen to, like, one, you know, we're going to listen to the Stones and the Beatles, or we're going to listen to more of that R&B, and you sort of muddle yeah. that. So could you talk a little bit about that idea of sort of the whitening of rock as well?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so this is one of the things, I mean, that is in a lot of ways the central concern of my book. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, one of the ways I put this sort of in the opening pages is that by the time Jimi Hendrix died in 1970, a lot of his obituaries thought it was totally remarkable that he was a black man playing electric rock guitar in a way that no one thought was remarkable when Chuck Berry was doing the same thing just right. 10 years earlier. And so what accounts for that shift? Like, what makes, by the end of the 60s, Hendrix is seen as totally exceptional and weird because of the combination of his racial and musical identity. And also why this shift happens in this decade that I think is really marked by this enormous amount of sort of interracial commercial crossover, aesthetic exchange, just sort of, there was so much mixing going on in music in this period. You know, thinking about things like Motown records and sort of the how integrated Southern soul was, you know, at places like Stax and Muscle Shoals. And then certainly, you know, the huge importance of groups like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, who were, you know, white British bands, but who were really steeped in African American music and sort of contemporary African American pop music, and really saw themselves as in conversation with and deeply indebted to a lot of those musicians and those types of music. And then, you know, but by the end of the decade, there's been this sort of resorting that's happened. And yeah, that was like, I mean, one of the things I was trying to accomplish with my book was sort of figure out, yeah, how does that happen? You know, like, does that happen because of, yeah, you know, like, it's like there's been different ways that this has been discussed. Like, one way is, you know, saying that, oh, putting the burden on R&B music and saying, well, you know, as the 60s progressed, R&B music becomes more and more reflective of Black cultural nationalist discourses, and it's sort of moving away from quote unquote white music or white audiences. I don't really think that that's true. I think it's true with some artists, but mm-hmm. for the most part, like, you know, the kind of political commitments of specific artists were really varied, you know, like, right. and this wasn't something that, and for a lot of Black artists, like, it also, there's an economic element of that explanation that doesn't really make sense. You know, it's like that, I think, you know, for a lot of musicians, you know, the first goal of their music is to, outside of, you know, self-expression is, you know, popular musicians, they want people to buy their records, you know, right. like, it's like, and there was a real material loss that was happening when, you know, as some of those artists started to see their sales drop with audiences that had previously been buying their music very enthusiastically. And then, yeah, you know, the other side that you sort of mentioned is like this, there's been a real denialism of this kind of thing in rock music, you know, this sort of an aversion to having conversations about race. And I think that some of that is because, you know, that sometimes these conversations get conducted in very sort of accusatory terms where, mm-hmm. you know, so-and-so, yeah, discourses of theft and things like that. You know, that Elvis stole rock and roll or Mick Jagger stole rock and roll. And, like, you know, these things I think are those are pretty limited ways of thinking about things. And they're, yeah, like they're kind of it's a way of I think that that's not a good way into having the conversation. But I think, you know, I think rock music as a sort of construction has often been very defensive or evasive when it comes to conversations about race. And so I wanted to find a way into the conversation into this topic that didn't feel like it was blaming artists or sort of blaming, you know, individuals, but that rather that did respect how much fluidity there was in this period. But that, like, kind of what ends up happening is that these people kind of end up falling back on these very long-standing beliefs about sort of innate differences in Black and white expressive capacity and what sort of Black music should be versus what white music should be. And these are ideas that have really, really deep roots in American racial thought. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it's like, and I think to me that was the notion that the reason that rock and roll becomes white is basically because of an almost like willful mishearing of the music in some quarters, right. is more compelling to me than the justification that it became white because, you know, X artist was a thief or a racist or something like that. You know, most of the artists that I deal with in this book, like, I came away, both Black and white artists, like, I actually came away with a real respect for how kind of open-minded they were. And, you know, certainly, like, dealing with the 60s, there's you know, people are less, some of these artists are less savvy about talking about these issues as we'd expect today.
Yes, I mean, so, yeah, I'd love to talk about some of the stuff Mick Jagger says, right? But what you're saying is very true, right?
Yeah, there was a real, like, you know, there was a real commitment to something with a lot of these artists. And there was a sort of, you know, at times very naive, but a sort of utopian impulse of, like, really kind of thinking, there was something that some of these artists were really going for, you know, mm-hmm. and it was like, and I think that it's easy to be cynical about that, you know, years after the fact. But I think that I, you know, and I'm certainly skeptical of it, but I did want to try to recover some of it and, you know, think about that. It's like, it didn't necessarily have to be the way that it ended up being.
Right. And you say that at the beginning, I think towards the beginning of your book, you bring up the Stones and you say that the Rolling Stones really pushed this idea of like, why are you listening to us?
Yeah.
Why? And then you come back to it at the end, right? You talk about the Stones at the end and just, we can move the book around. We don't have to talk it right straight through, but you talk about that idea, like the Rolling Stones, I think still get a lot of flack and a lot of what they do is can be, I mean, I like the Rolling Stones a lot. They're still really problematic.
Oh,
right?
Sure.
But in no way, shape or form were they saying like, this is our music.
Yeah.
You know, so can you talk a bit about the role of the, like, I think the Rolling Stones is really nice too. Well, no, I don't know if nice is the word, but I think one of the things that I got from reading your book and something that I think about often is that role of sort of violence and threat, especially rock and roll, right? Like I study punk. So there's that idea of threat within like that culture, but it started with the rock and roll. This, you know, like we can't, you know, that sort of like that being a public menace, that hysteria, that kind of thing.
Yeah, totally.
So can you talk a little bit about that and how you see that playing out? It plays out. You talk about it with Hendrix. You talk about it with the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, I mean, so this was something that, you know, with the Rolling Stones, like the Rolling Stones in a lot of ways are kind of the first rock and roll band that really embraces that sort of like public menace thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's like, you know, certainly it had been applied to Elvis. It had been applied to some degree to the Beatles, although not as extreme. But the Stones are the first group that really like owns that. And they own it from very early on. And I, you know, and some of this too was not even really them. It was they had this manager named Andrew Luke Oldham, who was extremely influential in crafting their image. And he really is, you know, Oldham's idea was to turn them into the anti-Beatles, essentially. You know, that this was going to be, they were going to be the, you know, if the Beatles were sort of cute and cuddly and charming, the Stones were going to be these like sullen, you know, miscreants, like, which they weren't really, you know, like, it's like they were all just, I mean, if anything, like, I mean, you know, Mick Jagger was a student at the London School of Economics and like, you know, this was very packaged, but the Stones didn't, I don't think, you know, and I think that there were times when they were probably irritated by it, but, they didn't ultimately really push against it. And certainly then kind of by the mid 60s, they have embraced it and they have realized that this is sort of like part and parcel of who they are and how the public sees them. And that was very, very, very tied up in their sort of perceived proximity to black music and their sort of like the fact that they were, and this is, you know, in the early coverage of the Rolling Stones, their knowledge of blues and R&B music, their sort of obsessive relationship to it comes up constantly, particularly in the British press, but also in the American press. But in England, like which is really where a lot of the sort of Stones as transgressive mythology originates. Like it's very, you know, in England in the early 1960s, the extent to which the Stones were steeped in black American blues music was very unusual. Like it was like, you know, this was some, or it was presented as such, at least by the by the British press. And yeah, you know, they were kids, you know, they were young, they, you know, had long hair. And yeah, and that was something that, and you know, similarly to, and it's interesting, like, you know, bringing up Hendrix, like Hendrix, who comes, you know, who kind of bursts onto the scene about 3 years after the Stones do, but sort of gets a lot of the same treatment leveled at him. But it's almost the reverse. Like with Hendrix, it's almost this like, oh, he's this black guy who's playing this white music for these white crowds. You know, that's how he's perceived. And so there's this, for both of them, there is a way that the sort of perceived crossing of kind of racial and musical boundaries gets bound up in this sort of idea of dangerousness. And obviously, like, sex is really, really tied into that. And certainly in the early coverage of the Rolling Stones, like, I mean, one of the most famous headlines ever about the Rolling Stones is from Melody Maker in 1964. And it's, would you let your sister go out with a Rolling Stone? That was like this blaring banner headline. And, you know, it was this story about how bad they were, you know, how sort of dangerous and threatening. And like, it's just like everything that's embedded in that, you know, is just like, obviously it's like, there's, you know, echoes of kind of like miscegenationist rhetoric. Certainly, like, I mean, there's just so much kind of tied up in that headline that becomes extremely powerful and popular. It gets repeated over and over again. American publications pick up on it and run it as well. It becomes like this really iconic piece of Stones coverage.
Right. It becomes this sort of moral panic that we need to stay away.
Yeah.
Right.
And
it's interesting because you bring up sort of Hendrix too. And I always find it interesting with Hendrix is he did not grow up like dirt poor in the South, right? He grew up in a pretty stable middle-class family, you know, got a good relationship with his father, went into the army, and we don't look at that history, right? And he also sort of paid his dues playing in bands. He didn't only play for white audience with all white musicians. And so that Hendrix myth, can you talk a bit about Hendrix and your thoughts on Hendrix and your research?
Sure. Yeah. So I would say that, like, honestly, so for me, it's interesting. Like, Hendrix for me was probably the hardest musician to write about in this book. And the reason for that is because, and this isn't a term that I use very often, but, and I don't even think I necessarily say it in the book, but, I mean, he is a genius in this way that other musicians that I've written about, I mean, all the musicians I write about are incredibly talented and just like, you know, I'm in awe of the music that they made. Hendrix is like really on a plane that is just pretty incredible. And it's like, and the thing about Hendrix is like, it makes him difficult to write about because there is something to Hendrix that is so unique. And there's something to him that is like, wow, there's like, you know, I mean, like the greatest artists, it's like, you know, you can pile up the influences and they still don't explain what you're left with. You know, there was something to Hendrix where he was hearing music in a way that no one had heard it before. He was hearing his instrument in a way that no one had heard it before. And just, you know, it's just astounding what he was able to accomplish in those few years. So there's this like, yeah. So in a way he was really challenging to write about because it's so hard to fit someone like that into a mold, you know, into an archetype or anything. He just resists everything. And I think that, and I started to appreciate in some ways, like the problem of writers who are trying to write about him at the time. Cause you know, it's like, what do you really say about this guy? There is something that is, you know, for as much as Hendrix was exoticized, like he was really exotic. Like he just was like, I mean, there was something, but he is something that it's like, you do see that kind of like, I mean, certainly in the British press, you know, as many people know, Hendrix really kind of rises to stardom initially in England. He goes to London in the mid-60s and becomes a sensation in the UK in 1966. And it's not till 67 that he sort of comes back to the States and becomes an international star. But early British press coverage of Hendrix is full of stuff about how like, oh, you know, he's like, I mean, like, saying that he came from like a Mississippi Delta background, which is totally bogus. You know, he's from Seattle. but there's also this element that's like Hendrix himself was known for not being super straight with interviewers, like much in the same way that Bob Dylan was, you know, like he played with these. I mean, Hendrix too was someone who really, really actively resisted any sort of categorization and was known for giving really opaque and kind of weird answers to questions about his music. You know, really a really great interview in a lot of ways because he was so funny and smart and just like had this really wonderful way of talking, but like not the most revelatory guy in terms of like him actually being straight with people about how he was conceiving of his work. I mean, in some ways he was revelatory. He just spoke about it in ways that are are sort of almost incredulous in terms of being someone reading them. But he is, I mean, it's he was really difficult to write about. And there is a way that you want to preserve the uniqueness of someone like that rather than trying to sort of fit him into a kind of broader lineage or something like that. Because there is something about Hendrix where he really does break the mold. And it's like seeing writers grapple with that. There's certainly so much writing about Hendrix during his lifetime. And a lot of it is kind of cringe-inducing looking back on it because of all of the stereotypes it plays upon. And yet at the same time, I think there was something about him that was incredibly hard to write about. So people tried to grab on something, anything that was familiar.
Right. And it makes sense that we, you know, you exoticize him, but yet he is, right? He still holds true to be like what most musicians, if not all guitar players, say the greatest or one of the greatest rock and roll guitar players ever.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So what do you talk about then if you can't? So sometimes that idea of race or what, you know, he's playing before a white audience makes sense. And you mentioned this idea that Hendrix sort of went to the UK and that's where he sort of started to play and started to come out. And so in the beginning of the book, you talk about the British invasion. And I think that is a really important element to this, right? So Hendrix goes to the other side of the Atlantic, but also this move for the Beatles, Dusty Springfield, people coming over here as well. So could you sort of talk about for you four elements of the British invasion? And so or the myths of the British invasion, but could you talk a little bit about that and why you think the British invasion is really important to this story?
Yeah. So, I mean, the British invasion is a really, you know, obviously it's a very famous concept. And it's sort of like become, you know, the concept being basically that, you know, the Beatles break in the States and really February 1964, that's when the Ed Sullivan Show is, although they start breaking a little bit earlier than that. And then, you know, kind of after the Beatles, it's just this deluge of British bands. Yeah, the Stones, the Animals, the Kinks, the Who later, just so many, you know, this sort of flood of bands. And so there's this sort of like, there's some truth to this, you know, like there is this, I mean, the Beatles are so important in terms of opening up that line, you know, there really had not been, British musicians had made very little impact on the American pop charts before the Beatles. And then all of a sudden, like the charts are kind of filled with British musicians, but there's a way that the British invasion concept, you know, this is something that's certainly like, classic rock radio will have like British invasion weekends, you know, there's whole big fan books about, you know, there's just like a huge, it's just a real powerful concept in sort of rock mythology. But I don't know, for me, it's sort of like there are so many differences between these bands and there's so many like, you know, for American audiences in the 60s who really didn't know very much about England, like there was this sort of tendency that it's like, oh, all these groups are sort of coming from the same scene, you know, and certainly, I mean, the most obvious example of this is like, you know, the most powerful dichotomy in rock history is probably the Beatles versus Stones thing.
Right.
And the Beatles and Stones actually had like really very little to do with each other. They were really, you know, it's like they came from very different backgrounds. The Stones are from London. The Beatles are from Liverpool. They were steeped in very different influences. They had, I think, very different ambitions, particularly early on. But one of the things that the British invasion myth like allowed for this idea that there was this kind of monolith of British bands that came in to the States. And it happens at this moment where in sort of historiography, or particularly like popular history, there's this idea that sort of American rock and roll was kind of on life support before the Beatles, that there was, you know, after, you know, Elvis is, you know, by the end of the 50s, like Buddy Holly's dead, Little Richard's quit secular music, Chuck Berry's about to go to prison, Elvis is in the army, and there's this sort of like that, like there's nothing happening in the U.S. besides, and then the Beatles come along and sort of, and this is like, it like, you know, Lester Bangs, the great music critic, rock critic, gave voice to this in a very famous essay that he wrote about the British invasion for the Rolling Stone Illustrated History of Rock and Roll, which, I mean, it's just, like, it's a nice story, but it's totally untrue. Like, it's like there was a huge amount of really cool stuff happening in American pop music. Like, I mean, 1963 is like a huge year in American pop music, and this is before the Beatles show up. But yeah, and so that was like, so I was sort of interested. And the other thing that is important about the, to sort of dispel about the British invasion, is that it wasn't simultaneous. Like, it's like, it wasn't like the Beatles break through and then suddenly there's all these bands. It's actually, particularly the Stones, it's like, it took the Stones a while to break through in the States. Like, it was, the Stones' first American tour was a disaster. Like, they were miserable. No one came to their shows. You know, it took them, it's not until June 1965, I think, that the Stones have their first American number one hit, and that was I Can't Get No Satisfaction. At that point, the Beatles had 8 American number one hits. So it was really like, this was, you know, it wasn't like the Stones were the Beatles to American audiences appeared to be an overnight success.
Right.
The Stones were absolutely not. The Stones were, you know, a band that had a lot of frustrations breaking through in the U.S. And really didn't have it. It wasn't until a bit later that the Stones established themselves as a real international commercial force.
Right. And then you talk about then with that, right, this sort of British invasion. Mm-hmm. And in the music world, like from 63 to 65 is a long time. Right. Mm-hmm. Like it.
Oh, certainly.
Right. Yeah. And then you bring in the Beatles and their connection and their relationship with Motown, which mm-hmm. I thought was this really interesting. And the role that Motown played with sort of I don't think creating the Beatles is the word I want to say, but that relationship. And so can you talk a little bit about that relationship?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the Beatles were extremely influenced by Motown. I mean, Motown and the Beatles, really, like, their success stories are actually pretty intertwined, both, you know, both artistically, but also kind of chronologically. So Motown, you know, starts in the late 50s. That's, you know, Berry Gordy founds right. Motown Records in the late 50s. But it's really not until 63 that Motown starts really taking off. As like, 63 is a big year for Motown. They have more top 10 hits in that year than they had had in their previous few years combined. 64 is an even bigger year for Motown. But 63 is the one where it's sort of like they really start, it really starts coming together for them. And that's the same year that the Beatles, you know, take off in the UK. And this 63 is the year of British Beatlemania. The Beatles obviously were very, very influenced by Motown music. With the Beatles, which came out in the UK on November 22nd, 1963, the same day as the Kennedy assassination, With the Beatles contained 3 covers of Motown songs. So it had Money, which is Money, That's What I Want, which is the first single ever released on Motown. They covered Please, Mr. Postman, which is the Marvelettes hit from 1960, which was actually the first number one that Motown Records ever had. And then they covered You've Really Got a Hold on Me by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, which had actually come out in 1963. So this was like, here are the Beatles covering this song that had come out a few months before with the Beatles, which is pretty extraordinary, you know, that this was. Mm-hmm. So that's how current it was. And that's how sort of up on this music they were, and particularly at a time when Motown wasn't big in the UK at that point. That was something that it was like, you had to be a real connoisseur to be seeking out Motown records, which the Beatles obviously were in the UK. The Motown wasn't particularly interested in the UK market at that point. Their records weren't widely available. It wasn't until 1965 that Motown really becomes a big success in the UK. And then, yeah, so there's obviously this big influence of Motown on the Beatles. But this becomes like a sort of, it becomes a real mutual admiration thing going on between these two entities. Motown artists became very quickly very taken with the Beatles and their success. There were, you know, lots of photos and stories of Beatles and Motown artists hanging out together. And there were also throughout the 60s a lot of really, really great Motown covers of Beatles songs. And two of the ones I write about in my book are Marvin Gaye's cover of Yesterday and Stevie Wonder's fantastic cover of We Can Work It Out from 1970.
Oh, I lost you.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, you just said Stevie Wonder.
Oh, Stevie Wonder's cover of We Can Work It Out from 1970. Yeah.
Right. And you talk, too, a bit about, like, the role that with Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder and how not only musically, but then how they were able to sort of push themselves to be more autonomous. I don't know if that's the word I want to use, but
yeah,
because of the Beatles, they went for a little more power and a little more control over what they were doing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this was something that, so Motown Records, was a famously controlling operation. Barry Gordy, the head of Motown Records, was just had a real kind of almost kind of tyrannical hold on his label and his artists. Like he just was, Motown was completely vertically integrated. It led to a lot of bitterness for Motown artists in years since, of people who felt like they were really kind of screwed over for their labor. Certainly with things like publishing and royalties, artists did not have particularly good deals with Motown. Motown artists for a long time were not allowed to have agents, which is pretty incredible. But Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye both are both really important. Marvin Gaye probably even more so than Stevie. The Marvin Gaye in 1970 decides that he wants to record the album that will go on to be What's Going On, which is obviously a landmark of 70s pop music. Barry Gordy didn't want him to do it. He was nervous about a political album. He's nervous about albums as a form in general. He felt that wasn't really where Motown's bread was buttered. But Marvin Gaye keeps pushing and pushing, threatening to sue and legal action and things like that. Gordy finally relents and allows Marvin Gaye to record What's Going On, which of course becomes a huge hit, very successful album for Motown. Stevie Wonder, who in 1970, who turns 21 years old in 1971, he sees all this happening. By Stevie Wonder's 21st birthday, Marvin Gaye is, What's Going On is already out and doing really well. Stevie Wonder basically goes to Barry Gordy and says he wants to, he wants to void his contract, which he was able to do having turned 21.
Right.
And renegotiate. He wants complete artistic control and control over his publishing too, which was extremely, no one had ever asked for that, or no one had ever gotten that from Motown before. And Barry Gordy, I think, wisely realizing the talent that he has with Stevie Wonder, agrees to this. And this is really which sets in motion basically Stevie Wonder becoming probably the dominant commercial and critical artist of the 1970s, just like, there was a way though that the Beatles are sort of implicated in this because of the fact that the Beatles in 1966 had renegotiated their own contract with Capitol Records to give them a huge amount of autonomy over their work. That was what allowed them to make Sgt. Pepper and allowed them to make their late 60s music. And that had reverberations across the whole recording industry. So I absolutely think that artists like Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder looked at that example and were like, I want that. Like, it's like that this was something that, So I think that there is a connection there.
Right. And what's interesting in reading your book is just the amount of remaking of songs, these covering of songs that happened within this sort of shorter period of time. So let's talk about the ladies for a little while, right?
Sure,
You talk about Aretha Franklin and Janis Joplin and Dusty Springfield. And I love, it was like the women, so I loved it anyway. But this idea of what is soul and the fact that these women, so I want to talk a little bit about that idea of like, who has soul? What is soul? But you also sort of push with them just how much they recorded each other, right? Or they, you know, which is really fascinating in such a short, it wasn't like 10 years later, I'm going to make this, a remake of this song. It's like, you know, like you said, like 3 months or a year later. So could you talk a bit about the idea of soul and also the sort of this idea of like the role that these women played in remaking songs? And
yeah, certainly. So yeah, so in the late 1960s, you know, really started, I mean, you know, it's hard to say when exactly it starts, but certainly 67, 68, 69, 70, you start to see a real rise in discussions of soul as a concept, you know, musical soul, and sometimes just sort of soul even more generally than that. And this question of who has soul, who doesn't have soul, you know, if soul is something that you're born with, or if soul is something you can pick up, you know, can you learn soul? And these were, you know, as you might imagine, were like really like basically very thinly coded ways of talking about race and sort of racial authenticity. And, you know, do white performers have a right to perform black music? You know, what are the sort of ethical obligations that go along with that that sort of performance? I mean, they were really kind of like, a lot of these were basically discussions over what we would, I think, now call cultural appropriation. And two flashpoints around this discussion were Aretha Franklin, who explodes into stardom in 1967, and in June of 68, she's on the cover of Time magazine, this really striking cover, and the headline of the cover story is The Sound of Soul. And it's this whole big article about soul and sort of Aretha as the embodiment of this concept. And the other flashpoint is Janis Joplin, who's someone who emerges almost precisely the same time. And it's someone who, you know, has this very spectacular performance style. She just commands a tremendous amount of attention, becomes an absolute sensation, both musically and also just sort of a media sensation. And she almost immediately becomes like very controversial as this sort of, you know, this white female blues singer who was somewhat prone to shoot her mouth off in interviews about things.
Just a little.
And just was like, you know, was a real larger than life persona. You know, this was someone who was like, I mean, Janis Joplin was just a huge star, like a star in the sort of in the almost sort of like the most basic sense. Like she was just an electrifying personality. So I write a lot about that history of those two artists and the way that they were often compared to each other. Like they were often like, which is something that I feel like is, we now wouldn't think to put those artists in next to each other, but in the late 60s, they were really like, there were a lot of people who were like Aretha versus Janis kind of thing. And a lot of it had to do with these questions of who was, you know, who was authentic, who was really soulful and who wasn't, you know, is Janis Joplin soul music? And then like the question of songs, like one of the things that was really interesting too, and I also in that chapter write about Dusty Springfield, who's a great white British R&B singer who's much less well known in the States. She's not totally obscure or anything, but she's not as big a name as Aretha or Janis Joplin, but who is someone who was kind of this, you know, a third party to all of this, who makes a really wonderful album in 1968 called Dusty in Memphis that contains probably Dusty's most famous song, Son of a Preacher Man, which is a song that's written originally for Aretha Franklin. And Aretha Franklin didn't want to record it because she thought its content was too risque. She ultimately does record it, but only after Dusty has had a hit with it. And there's just so much overlap in terms of the sort of songs that people are performing, like one of Janis Joplin's most famous songs is Piece of My Heart, which was a cover of a song of Piece of My Heart that was originated by Aretha Franklin's sister, Irma Franklin, in 1967. And then also, you know, Aretha Franklin, who like one of the things that I think Aretha Franklin maybe doesn't get enough credit for. I mean, obviously Aretha Franklin gets a lot of credit for a lot of things, all deserved. But I think something that we don't talk enough about is that, you know, I think Aretha Franklin is maybe the greatest cover artist of all time. Like, it's like Aretha Franklin's covers of other people's music is just totally extraordinary. In fact, I wouldn't even say maybe. I think she's absolutely, you know, just thinking about, I mean, you know, her most famous recording probably is her cover of Otis Redding's Respect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, then, but, you know, in the throughout the 60s and into the 70s, you know, she makes... she has an amazing cover of the Beatles' Eleanor Rigby, an amazing cover of Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water. And I mean, just so many. She covers The Weight by The Band. I mean, just the list goes. She covered Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones. And yeah, and thinking about that sort of thing too, like it's like, okay, where do you put the role of songwriters, and where do you put the role of songs in all this? Like that, it's like thinking about soul and thinking is always about performance. Really, it's like a very, you know, thinking about like musical authenticity often takes root at the idea of performance, but it doesn't really often consider. It's like, well, where is the material coming from, and who are the other people on the recording, you know, like it's like it's like, so that's a rambling answer, but that's that chapter.
It's, no, it's fine, because I'm still sort of, trying to let settle with myself this idea, like when you talk about these women, they, like everybody else, wrote their own songs. Right.
Yeah.
But these three women that you pick, which it makes sense that you pick these three, right?
Yeah.
I think sometimes we don't think about like who wrote the song. Like, did they write? They didn't write their songs, right? Whatever they're doing, they're not right. You know what? And what does that mean to not be? For me, I'm like pushing this. Like, they're also women, and they're also not songwriters, right?
Yeah.
But there's other women songwriters. But they're just, you know, there's women songwriters that are writing songs for other folks. But...
Oh, absolutely, yeah, yeah. And I mean, this is one of the things I write about in that chapter, is that like, so there's idea that's like come about in, like in rock music in particular. There's this real premium placed on like, who do you write your own songs?
Yes.
Do you write your own songs? And you know, I think that's like, it's kind of a. I don't know what there's like a misplaced importance on that. You know, that it's like, I mean, one of the things I wanted to talk about in that chapter is that like, so one of the reasons that they're not writing their own songs is because the music industry was so sexist at that point that they're really like the notion of a female singer songwriter. I mean, frankly, like the notion of a male singer songwriter, even in that era, you know, the Beatles are another reason the Beatles are important is that they wrote their own stuff. And certainly like, there have been other, you know, performers who'd written their own material. You know, Chuck Berry wrote all his own material. Buddy Holly wrote his own material. But like, you know, Elvis didn't write his
own material. No, few and far between,
yeah. And it's like, and so that was a relatively new idea, that you would have, you know, the Beatles being a self-contained band that wrote their own songs. And, you know, certainly like a place like Motown, most Motown artists didn't write their own songs. Like, it's like, you know, there was a whole songwriting staff at Motown. I mean, there were exceptions. Smokey Robinson wrote a lot of his own music. Stevie Wonder started to write more and more of his own music. But, you know, a performer like Marvin Gaye wasn't particularly encouraged to write songs. So this was something, there was a way that this, and particularly for female performers, this was something that it was like, I mean, Aretha did write some of her stuff. She has co-writing credit on some of it. But, I mean, there was this real sense in the music industry in that period of that was, you know, women sang songs written for them. There absolutely were female songwriters. I mean, probably the big, you know, the most iconic of this period is Carole King, who writes everything. You know,
right.
She wrote You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman for Aretha. But it's not until a little bit later that Carole King is able to step out and inhabit that role of female singer-songwriter, you know, in the way that she's, you know, with Tapestry.
Right, was, yeah.
Yeah.
And Tapestry came out when? In the early
70s? Yeah. And so this is like, so yeah, you're still in this period of, where that wasn't like really, I don't want to say not a possibility, but that was itself a sort of fraught position. But I also just wanted to, yeah, in that chapter, kind of draw attention to the fact that it's like there's a lot of different forms of like really great musical artistry, and like not all of them have to do with like, do you write your own songs? You know, right. I mean, Aretha Franklin's music is light years better than most people that have written their own songs.
Right. No, and like that idea of like you don't need to write your own songs to have soul. Right. That.
Yeah.
Like toying with that idea of soil. I can't. Soul is really fascinating, but it just made me start to think about that idea of like when, right? So I thought of the band I thought of was Heart, right? Like when do women in rock start, yeah. Right? That big sort of like Carole King was like the singer-songwriter, Joni Mitchell, the singer, you know, it's that like, let's not call it rock and roll, let's call it something else, totally. Which is what you really were getting at with this sort of idea of soul too, right? Like if it has soul, is it rock and roll or do we call it R&B or do we call it something else?
Right.
So just not to leave them out, you start out and sort of with this sort of birth of the 60s with Sam Cooke and Bob Dylan, mm-hmm. which I love that juxtaposition of both of them, right? Because this idea of like the black authenticity and the folk authenticity and, mm-hmm. and sort of this creation of Dylan. And you mentioned it early on, but that idea like, did Dylan quit being folk when he plugged in, right? Yeah. And that whole thing. So could you talk a little bit about maybe the birth of the 60s and why you chose Dylan and Cooke?
I mean, Sam Cooke, I mean, just from a totally personal perspective, like Sam Cooke is probably my favorite singer of all time. And so when I was really starting to work on this project, that was some of the earliest material that I wrote for this, particularly the Sam Cooke material. Because, like, yeah, one of the things I was really struck by is how little has been written about Sam mm-hmm. Cooke. He's someone who, you know, there's really only been two full-length books that have been written about him. You know, there was a very good academic article that was published about him a few years ago, but that's really the only pretty significant piece of Sam Cooke's academic scholarship. You know, he gets touched upon a lot by places, but it's like, you know, histories of R&B in the 60s often treat him as sort of a precursor or outlier figure, which is a little weird considering like Sam Cooke dies in late 1964. So he was very present in the 60s, you know. And yeah, so I sort of got interested in sort of like, why haven't more people written about Sam Cooke? Like, why, you know, Sam Cooke is a really important musician and someone who is, his contributions to 60s music are massive, you know, mm-hmm. as someone who is, he's the first singer to cross over from gospel to pop. Like, it's like, you know, and do so spectacularly. And I mean, that's so important. Like, that is like the commercial blueprint for so much of 60s R&B is that particular crossover. And and he's someone who's often credited with, because of that crossover, with sort of quote unquote inventing soul music. And yet he's someone who often gets sort of left out of a lot of the conventional histories of soul music, or again, treated as sort of like a forerunner. And I just became very interested in that story of Sam Cooke, who in 1963 was totally obsessed with Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind and wrote A Change is Gonna Come, which is probably these days Sam Cooke's most famous composition.
Right.
He wrote it really as kind of a response to Blowin' in the Wind. He was, you know, very inspired by that song. And so that got me thinking about Bob Dylan in the early 60s and sort of like at that moment. And Bob Dylan, who's someone who is the most written about popular musician probably ever. You know, this is like Bob Dylan's got hundreds of books written about him. And sort of the commonalities and the similarities and differences between these two figures and this sort of brief but really significant moment of overlap that happens with these two songs. And sort of the ways that Sam Cooke and Dylan have sort of functioned in the genres that they supposedly represent. You know, Cooke as soul and Dylan as rock, because Dylan, you know, there's also a very kind of common saw that, you know, like a Rolling Stone is the moment that kind of rock music becomes serious. It's sort [S2] Right. [S1] Of like the birth of rock as a form distinct from rock and roll. You know, and it's like, this is so, you know, Sam Cooke leaves gospel to go to pop, and Dylan really leaves folk to go to pop. You know, right. These are things that happen. Like, it's like both these artists make these moves, and yet they get coded in very different ways. Like, one of the things I think that one of the reasons Sam Cooke doesn't get written about that much is that there's a discomfort with his crossover. There's a discomfort with his pop side. You know, this is like, people want to write about a change that's going to come because it's so, it's just a perfect piece of music, first of all, but it's also like, you know, so politically righteous, and, you know, it's everything we want to, you know, it's like the comfortable Sam Cooke. And so is his gospel material. You know, his gospel material is just so, so beautiful and powerful. But his pop material, which people don't really know. I think a lot of people don't really know what to do with, since it's a little bit. I don't know what the right word is. You know, it's so market conscious. It's so calculated and things like that. But like, it's like, as opposed to seeing that as a compromise on Sam Cooke's part. Like, I mean, to me, it actually speaks to just how versatile of an artist he was, and how ambitious he was. How incredibly adept he was at realizing his ambition. And I think that for someone like Sam Cooke, like, the music that he made in that vein was just as important to him as the music that he made that's important, that other people have deemed important. You know, like, it's like, and like, yeah, why do we withhold that recognition from him? What is it about that music that makes people uncomfortable? That's sort of what I wrote about in that chapter.
And do you think this is, and I don't know the answer to this, but in reading, and I think this happens a lot, especially in this time in music, that a lot of this, like, you talk about rock and violence, but a lot of these folks died in some violent ways, right? Or violence happened. And so do you think some of the Sam Cooke stuff has to do with the circumstances in which he died? Or do you think that's a whole separate?
That's a really good question. Yeah. So Sam Cooke, dies under very mysterious circumstances. He shot to death in a seedy motel in Los Angeles in December of 1964. It's a murder that has really never been adequately explained. A woman confessed to it, and she was a hotel employee, confessed to the murder, but she claimed that Sam Cooke, she thought Cooke was a robber. So the shooting was chalked up as, you know, sort of a combination of self-defense and accident. So no one was ever brought to justice for his murder. It's a very weird circumstance. Like, it's like, you know, to this day, there's a lot of mystery there. You know, no one's really sure what exactly he was doing at that hotel.
Yes, there's many stories. There's many theories to what happened.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many theories. Yeah. And I do think that at the time, there was a way that people didn't know how to talk about what happened there. I mean, people still don't know how to talk about it because they don't know what happened.
Right.
There's a way. It is really tragic. I mean, it's so tragic. Certainly the fact that his life was cut short at that moment, when he really is, I think, starting to move into really interesting and new directions. I mean, throughout Sam Cooke's whole career, he's moving in interesting and new directions. But, you know, it's A Change Is Gonna Come wasn't released as a single until after his death. It actually reminds me of someone who I don't get to write about that much in my book, but is Otis Redding, who dies in December of 1967. And Otis Redding was only 26 when he died, and, you know, he dies, and his music was moving in really, interesting directions too. He was someone who I think, you know, if he's one of the great, like, you know, what might have been, stories. I mean, there's so much tragic early death in the 60s, but in a lot of ways, like, someone like Cooke, and particularly someone like Otis Redding, where there's something so senseless about it. You know, it's not a drug overdose. It's not a sort of self-destruction that ends up happening. It's something even weirder and more fluky. And so there's something about that that's really, I put Buddy Holly in that.
I was just going to say that sounds like a very Buddy Holly kind of So we've been talking for a while, so I don't want to keep you forever, but I could keep talking about it. But what's your, so where are you going next? Do you have another project in the works or?
Yeah, I sort of got like, so I haven't really started writing anything yet. I do have another project in the works. I'm like a little hesitant to.
That's fine. Like, I didn't know if you had something.
Yeah, I do have something. It's like, it's a little different than this project. It's still music related. And it's going to be a little bit more recent, like a little bit more contemporary. So I'm not going backwards. I'm going forwards. But it'll still mostly be a historical project. I'm still, part of my hesitation of talking about it is that I'm not entirely quite sure what it is just yet.
Right. But there's still lots to talk about, even more recent with music and
race
and rock. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. I really appreciate it. And just again, this was an interview with Jack Hamilton, who wrote Just Around Midnight, Rock and Roll and the Racial Imagination. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me on.